Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
We have another packed show. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Berner. He goes by Berner, B-E-R-N-E-R, who I didn't know much about before we got his book, Becoming Legend, Get Rich and Leave a Legacy. But now I know a lot about him. And this guy kind of crushes whatever field he is in. It might be cannabis, it might be music, it might be clothing, but he crushes. So we're looking forward to him. And our friend Shane Mullen is going to be with us in just a couple of minutes because he's got two authors he is nominating for The Pitch, our writing competition, which is really exciting. But first, Claude doing the important work, and we have something to talk to Claude about, David and Jamie. David, let's do you first. What was the big takeaway from the NFL draft for you, or the most interesting takeaway from the NFL draft?
I'm in honor of the draft being in your hometown. I am wearing,
I see that. I'm loving it.
Pittsburgh shirt.
Nice. It's a good looking jersey.
Thank you. It is a good looking jersey and just breathtakingly beautiful ballpark. It's just too bad about the team.
Do the best we can. I think Pittsburgh did really well for the draft.
They did. I think they did
really stood up. That snarky little guy from NBC Channel 4. Well, I don't know if he's snarky. Adam Tuss. Oh, no.
I don't know if he's snarky or not.
J.P. Finley. I'm sorry, J.P. Finley.
J.P. I know J.P.
Apologies J.P.'s to Adam Tuss.
Yeah. Okay, he was there. He gets into town to Pittsburgh, my hometown. This is Chatter on Hometown. A few days in advance, and he's doing a live with Channel 4 in D.C., and he's talking about, I don't know, there's just not much going on here. You know, I can see where D.C. could really have a really great draft. But he was kind of trashing the Berg. But I think they exceeded expectations.
You're defensive about the Berg.
Yeah, with good reason. Okay, but what was your biggest takeaway other than the Berg?
I don't know. You know, obviously there wasn't a ton of movement at the top of the draft. There was a player who a lot of people thought would go second to the Jets, who wound up dropping to the other New York team who was drafting fifth, the Giants. So that was a bit of a surprise. But for the most part, there wasn't a ton of major deals made. You know, everybody kind of stood in place. Philly moved up to get a receiver who will help them. And they, unfortunately, I'm sorry, they moved ahead of your Steelers who are about to draft them. That's life in the big city, as you know.
Life in the big city. That's all right. It seemed, I know next to nothing about it, but it all seemed relatively straightforward, relatively, we thought that would happen. What do we think of the Commanders pick?
The first round pick? Very good.
Yeah.
Sonny Styles is very, very, very intriguing. He was a defensive back. They converted him 2 years ago to linebacker, and he didn't lose any of his quickness, and he's a lot stronger now, and is really, he has a chance to be a very, very good player in the league. And he, by all accounts, he was the team captain. You know, he was thought of very highly by his peers in real time. I am always curious on any team, whether it's football, basketball, whatever, that has a lot of pro prospects on it. How do they all play together when they all want to be drafted high, you know? Yeah. So a lot of times it could disintegrate into, well, I'm just going to do what I do, and I don't care if the team does well. And that didn't happen at Ohio State. One of the other players that was a teammate of his got drafted like five picks later. They had like six or seven guys off of that defensive unit get drafted. Did Ohio State have the most picks? I don't know which school had the most.
It seemed
picks.
Like a lot.
I'm sure they were right up there with Michigan and some of the, you know, other football factories.
Yeah. I think they had four in the first round too, right?
Yeah. I mean, they had a really good team. Yeah, right. So that wouldn't surprise me. I think he's got a chance. But you never know because it's football. Guys get hurt. And I mean, that's not an excuse. Guys get hurt and they have career-ending injuries a lot. So you just don't know. It's a very violent sport.
Okay, we don't know about that, but we do know that Claude recently was in my neck of the woods, Sperryville, Virginia. Claude, pleased to share where you were this past Monday.
I was at Schoolhouse 9, which is a par 3 9-hole golf course, doing a charity event with Little Lights. They are a nonprofit that does work in Southeast D.C. With people there in Ward 7 with after school programs. Food programs, education programs, all kinds of things.
Nice.
I was raising money. I had to walk 100 holes. in one day. And I
That's a
made
lot.
it. It's a lot. It's a lot. And so, but I made it. There's one loop there where you can do three of the shorter holes repeatedly, which is fine. But Little Lights is such an amazing organization. The guy David Lee that heads it up, he's a great guy, and his wife Jessica was out there with them and some other folks. And yeah, we did it. You know, I walked
Nice.
100.
Yeah.
Got
I
out to
happened to be
pay.
driving by
Yeah.
said golf course that Monday morning,
I
and
text you.
I had the heat on my car, in my car. It was very brisk that morning, and I
I have
saw a
to
bunch of people on the Schoolhouse Nine, which is a bit of a, it's a bit of a cult status kind of golf course. It was
get you.
designed by Mike McCartan, who's pretty famous. But anyways, I saw a bunch of people. I'm like, wow, good on them being out there in the cold. And then I'm texting Claude later. He was one of them who was out there.
Yeah, I was out there. I was the one with the layers and the hat, the hoodie over the hat, trying to protect myself from the wind.
It
And I
really
shot
contributes
pretty
to a great
good.
swing.
My goal was more pars than bogeys. And we're not going to worry about birdies. Whatever the number of birdies, that's fine. But more pars than bogeys. We did that because I had a few donations that were predicated on the amount of pars that I got. You know,
Nice.
$5 per par, 10 per par. And there's just a lot of people who still haven't paid yet, but they owe Little Lights a lot of money because
That's
I was getting
excellent.
pars out there. I was
Good
how
for
do we know
you
you
for
did how do we
doing
know you
that.
didn't cheat at all? Was there any oversight?
As some would say in post game press conferences, I'm not going to answer that question. The score is what it is, Jamie. Yeah, I'm not going to answer that.
You didn't
The
so glad you were in the hood.
any balls into the hole while no one was looking. All right.
No,
Good
you
enough.
know, well, here's the thing. There were a few that were out there that were $2,000 for any hole in ones. And it was a par three, so you could have a chance on any hole. But I didn't do that. I'll put it, I didn't do any hole in
Good for
ones.
you.
And so,
Good for
or is
you.
it
Glad
holes
you
in
were out
ones?
there.
Yeah, whatever.
So
Yeah.
speaking of pitching, Shane. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us. Thank you for nominating a couple authors for The Pitch, which is our writing competition. We know the world doesn't need another writing competition, but needed this one, where independent bookstores nominate authors from their area. You have two awesome authors, and how about you introduce us to them?
Wonderful. Yes, thank you so much for having me back and for being able to introduce my authors. I'm so proud to have selected these two books. They are fantastic, represent the Midwest, and are so like fantastic. Two of the best books I've read in years. So I have Babylon, South Dakota by Tom Lin and Young World by Soman Chainani. And they are wonderful books, both novels. One is primarily for young adults, but they are timeless, classic, and say so much about the climate, which the way these books talk to each other is incredible. I was astounded that I was able to choose two books that were able to say so much about the world in such unique ways. So I would like to leave a lot of time for the authors to speak. They are both
Yeah.
here tonight. And I want them to have an opportunity to talk about their books a little bit.
Great. Tom Lin, you're up first. Give us, we love backstories on our authors here. So give us a tiny backstory. And then I know a little bit about your career, which is incredible. And I love what you've been doing. But tell us a little bit about the book, which has
Yeah,
great cover art,
absolutely.
by the way. Great
Oh,
cover art.
yeah. I mean, it's gorgeous. The artist who did the cover for this book, same artist who did the first book, and he's like a savant. We give him the book.
Yeah.
He disappears for, 3 months. He comes back and it's a hole in one every time.
Keeping on the golf theme.
Keeping
Keeping
on the
on the
golf
golf theme.
theme. So my name's Sam Lin. I was born in China. I moved to the US when I was about 4 or 5 to New York. And I came out with my first book in 2021. And this is my second book. And I think I'm interested in putting Chinese American characters in kind of traditionally American or Western American context. I think that's really interesting. And I'm a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Iowa. I teach in the English major. We're finishing up our semester now. And I have invited all my students to purchase my book. We'll see how that
Oh,
goes.
so good of you. So good of you. Yeah.
I encourage them. And I do keep a list. But the book is it follows a Chinese immigrant family as they move to a homestead in South Dakota around the 1970s or so, and they start to build a life for themselves. They have a daughter, they adopt a dog,
But along the way, the U.S. government installs a nuclear missile silo on their property, and seem to be doing strange experiments. And from there, the story just gets weird. I've been describing it as Stranger Things meets East of Eden. But
Pretty
then
good.
Stranger Things season
Pretty
five
good.
was such a miss that now I want to constrain it to Stranger Things season one meets East of Eden.
Good. Yeah, you always want to set up the sequels. The little bit I've been able to read about it thus far, I thought, okay, well, no, this is kind of believable. In the 70s, and the government could have done these things, and then it does start going down these paths. How do you, what's the governor when you're writing this? How far do you feel comfortable pushing something? And when do you go, okay, wait, that's just too weird? Like, how believable do you want to keep it versus I just want to be your very, very creative and great imagination?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it like a cantilever, right? Like there, you need to have enough mass on the kind of grounded and realistic side of things to allow you to kind of extend out over the valley of imagination and pick weirder and wilder things. But if you want, I mean, the way I think of it is if I want something really strange and fantastical to happen, it has to take place in an incredibly grounded, really kind of factual environment first, where everyone's reacting to it as though it's factual, as though it's real. I mean, I love doing research for my books. I mean, a lot of that is because I really despise the writing of the book, and research feels just as productive. But you know, a lot of this research I feel for me is a way to put my foot down in reality and give myself the kind of ability to go roaming in weirder plots or
Yeah.
stranger narratives.
It's funny what you just said. And I was thinking about David Marinus the other day, who we've had on the show a couple of times. Phenomenal researcher, phenomenal writer. He loves writing. Even when we were talking about, if you guys remember, he says, I'm just, goes, he'll do 3 or 4 years of research on one of these books. And then he goes, I just cannot wait to start writing. He's one of the few writers who says that. One of the few.
Yeah, freaks, superhumans, just like, you know, I feel like sometimes I meet these authors that really do like writing, and I feel like how little kids must have felt when they like told Muhammad Ali that they were doing boxing. Like, you know, we're doing the same thing, but you're on a different level.
That's awesome. David, Jamie, Claude, anybody?
Well, I would just like to say, as a person who writes for a living, that I like having written. I don't actually like doing the writing. I like admiring it, not immediately because it never looks good immediately, but you know, a couple of weeks or months or even years later, it doesn't look that bad. And I like, so it's kind of like I don't like the work. I like sitting back and admiring it after it's done.
Okay, but David, before you chime in, Jamie and David, you both very, very good writers, which I know, and you've written for years. Now, the immediacy of the media in which you work, I think that's plural is the correct one. Do you miss having good, thoughtful editors, or do you still have some editing?
Still have some, not, but you miss time. I've said this before.
Yeah.
It's not so much that the editing is bad, is that nobody has enough time to do it correctly. Now, I don't have enough time to write it correctly. They don't have
Right.
enough time to edit it correctly because it has to get put out immediately. And that is where we are failing as an industry, is that we have allowed time to become the arbiter of everything that we produce.
That's the
And
driving
it should be the
force.
exact opposite.
So funny story. I send my I do a weekly magazine article. I'm never happy with it, but as a deadline is Wednesday at close of business, it has to go in. So it just has to be good enough. And I sent it to my editor, and I said, you know, I'm just sending this to you with the hope that maybe that you could make it a little better, and you know, maybe break up some of the sentences or move things around. And then he was very apologetic. It was like, well, you know, because he doesn't have time to do that. You know, I have to rewrite everybody's article. I'm never, you know, it's the magazine's never going to get out. So it's just going to be as good as you wrote it. And that's about it.
Good enough. Jamie, do you look back on your stuff really seriously and go, okay, I thought that holds up pretty well. David, do you?
Yeah. I do sometimes. Sometimes I'll go back. Well, sometimes I forget that I've written something, and somebody will say, "Hey, you wrote this great piece a few years ago," and I'll go, "I did," and then I'll go back and look at it.
Well, I write a
And
daily newsletter, and I don't usually look
yeah.
at that thing, but I do write a weekly magazine article, and it actually comes out in a glossy magazine. And I told my big boss one time, I said, "You know what I do when I get the magazine, because I subscribe to it?" I said, "The first thing I do is I get it, I rip it in half." And he's like, "What?" And I said, "Yes, I take it, I rip it down the spine, and I take my article out and I put it in a little notebook, and then I read the rest of the magazine. But it really improves in time, because when you're writing something in the moment, you know all the things you didn't get in, the points you should have made better. And then when you read it a year later, you've forgotten all that. So what's there is what the reader saw, and it doesn't look that bad, at least not to me.
If I could have a second, Tori, I do want to ask. So, like with David and Jamie, like I know there may not be any consideration for this at all, but is there any thought of like what you consider perfection for the consumer? The consumer may consider what you've given already perfect, like the, and so your judgment of it wasn't the best is because of what you consider this is what it should be versus what someone may read it and say, oh, this was great.
Well, here's the thing. I know good writing when I read it. It's easy to read. It's a delight to read. And so I know the difference between truly great writing and serviceable writing that's done sometimes under journalism deadlines. And I would say I'm a serviceable writer. I'm not a great writer.
Okay. Tomlin, put on your.
Yeah, let's ask Tom that question.
Yeah, no, Tom, put on your teachers, because David has the great American novel in him. He just hasn't decided what he wants to write about. Jamie probably does. He doesn't talk about wanting.
I have the great American memoir, which I'm going to write once I retire.
Also fiction. But Tom, how would you encourage these two very successful, very respected, hardworking journalists to transition into fiction? Like, what if you had a student that loved nonfiction, but you're encouraging them to try fiction? What would your persuasive pep talk be?
I would say that fiction will seem like it's going to be easier because you can just make stuff up and you don't have to go out and find it and have it be true. But it's actually going to be way harder because you don't have those parameters. You don't have those constraints. And so when you're faced with the problem of fiction, which is deciding what story to tell from the infinite field of all possible stories, you're going to hit paralysis. And so the easiest way to get started is to give yourself some boundaries, right? So I'm only going to write within this time period, or I'm going to focus on this object. It'll take us through the whole thing. And then after you get started, my only advice would be you got to finish the thing. It'll be very tempting to jump ship, move to another project that's shinier and more exciting. And I always tell my students, finishing something is a skill in and of itself. And if you don't practice it, you'll never figure out how to do it well. So get to the end.
In writing your new book, did you take your own advice? Again, there's so much untold history about Chinese in the United States, Chinese Americans, that the West would not have been one without them, all of those things. And you started to go into this. I think the New York Times talked about your other book, The Thousand Crimes of Minsu. It said, with a Chinese American gunslinger, he's challenging the whiteness of Westerns. There's a lot of truth and reality there, but there's also the historical fiction side of it. So do you take that advice yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the idea, and I always say, like, ideas are cheap, right? They're like dime a dozen. Everyone can come up with a great idea sitting around a table, but then you have to go and you have to make it into something that other people want to read and enjoy. And so I had the idea of, let's do a Western with an Asian American protagonist, but I didn't have a story until I began doing research and I was able to winnow down, you know, where would he have been? Like how would he have worked? What is it like to be in those deserts in the 1860s? And similarly with Babylon, South Dakota, it's based on my doctoral research that I was doing for my dissertation, which is on nuclear missiles and science fiction. And so
say it again.
Oh, my doctoral dissertation is on science fiction and nuclear missiles.
Awesome.
And so I was going to all these places anyways. I was like, I don't want to waste all this research that I'm doing. And I think there's a story here as well. But you give yourself limits, right? Like you give yourself rules of engagement so that you can go in and you can begin pinning this story down where it needs to be pinned down. Awesome. I don't think I would have been able to tell this story if I had to just sit alone at home and imagine.
Ah, okay. David and Jamie, inspiration for you. Hey, Claude, do we have Samani on? I only have our other nominated author. I only have so many boxes across the top.
We do.
Shane, reintroduce.
Okay. Soman Chainani for Young World.
Also great cover.
It's beautiful cover. And it's a beautiful book. It has illustrations in it, and it is like it's graphs and just an incredible, unique read. And again, so timeless, but yet so grounded in today's world. It is about a young, like 17-year-old kid who decides that he is going to upend the world and becomes president of the United States. And it is not an easy task for him. But it is really incredible, and it's very political. It says a lot about, again, climate and just like the story, the characters, everything about it is just phenomenal. And now I would like someone to talk about his book.
Sure. Where should I start? I guess I can give you a little bit of background, which is that I wrote the School for Good and Evil series for 13 years. I was the fairy tale guy, because that was my debut novel, and it kind of took off like a bottle rocket, you know? And when you have a hit, you kind of go with it. So I wrote six books, two prequels. There was a big movie from Netflix. I was kind of the fairy tale guy, and I could have kept being the fairy tale guy for the rest of my life. The issue was I was doing a lot of visits in schools over those 10 years, you know, so I went to over 500 schools, and got to see kids, you know, from 2013 where they barely knew how to use smartphones through COVID and afterwards. And
Wildly exuberant crowds, by the way. Having done a lot of work with schools, sure, they can get dragged to an event, but they don't have to be enthusiastic about it. They were crazy about you. Absolutely crazy about
I
you.
mean, it was what's interesting though is I think over the course of time, I noticed a change in the kids, you know, and I felt like the way I described them is they went from like kids, they were awkward, innocent, goofy, you know, kind of weird. They were just normal kids. And by 2022, 23, I felt that they were more like tired, wired, like skeptical. Like there was this kind of checked out, sort of addled look in their eye, you know, whenever I did these presentations. And it just took a bigger threshold to get them into it. You know, they were afraid of books. Books became something that they just didn't feel were for them anymore. Their attention spans were decreasing. And so I realized that I wanted to write a book that instead of making them escape to fairy tale worlds, would help them transform this one. And so I spent a year researching how a teenager could end up president realistically in America, and created the scenario of Young World. This is the finished copy, which is so day-glow neon, it doesn't even show up on the screen. But it's about a 17-year-old who, through a series of dominoes falling, ends up being made president by the Supreme Court for 24 hours in order to prevent a Republican and Democrat from trying to steal the election to each from each other. The 17-year-old had made the mistake of uploading a viral video telling people to write him in as a protest vote against two 70-year-olds running for president. And he, instead of getting a few thousand votes and a few thousand views, he gets 55 million. And so it prevents the Republican Democrat from getting to 270. The Supreme Court, you know, makes him president for 24 hours to prevent anarchy. And in those 24 hours before the Republican and Democrat can compromise and kick the kid out of office, eight other governments fall to teenagers around the world. And that's in the first 25 pages of the book.
I have to say, when Shane first sent me your names and your books, and I was looking up the essence of the books, and then when you first hear about this and 17-year-old becoming president, you're like, okay. And then the more I was reading about it, it's like, okay, we could do worse. We
Yes, we could do
maybe
worse.
you know, we could do worse. And I was finding myself getting very hopeful. And then I'm texting it to my 20-something children, going, okay, this is not completely beyond belief, or at least hope, I guess.
No, and try the whole purpose of the book is to make it as realistic as possible and also entertaining as possible, so that, you know, young people who read it like internalize the idea of, okay, what would I do as president, and start thinking that way, so that, you know, when the right person comes, I want them to run for school board and kick the old
Right.
people off. I want them to run for city council and kick the corrupt people who've been there forever off. Like, I want them to run downstream for office, you know, because the message of the book is no one's coming to save you. His campaign is run on four words, which is right to be young, right?
Yeah.
Young people have lost that right. And so that's the whole purpose of this book, is you've lost that right. They're not giving it back to you. You have to get it back. And that requires revolting.
Okay. Well, big thanks to both of you, Tom and Saman, but Shane, mostly to you. Thank you very, very much for being a part of this and for introducing, not finding, because both of you, Tom and Saman, are really well known, well respected, deservedly great authors. But thank you, Shane, for introducing them to us and the Chatter family. The next couple of months, we're going to talk with some of the more of the nominees, and then we'll winnow it down and have a winner this fall. But thank you for the good work you're doing, and please keep it up and come back.
And I just added The School for Good and Evil on my Netflix watch list.
There you go.
Had
Enjoy
that
it.
going for me.
It's a very big budget attempt to capture 8 books into 2 hours.
But better than not being captured.
Exactly. Better than helping.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks,
Thank you,
guys.
Tori, Jamie,
Good luck.
David, Claude, and thank you,
Thank
Shane,
you,
for having us
guys.
here.
Thank you, Tom, and someone like for writing these incredible books.
Thanks again. See you soon.
Bye.
Take care, guys.
Thank you, David. I have a hard time multitasking, and so I'm like, okay. But now we have Burner.
Yeah,
We
he's
do.
waiting
Just waiting
patiently.
for him to
Sorry. For
un.
some
There we
reason.
go. Yep.
Hello
Last.
there.
How you doing?
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Just lounging in L.A. right now.
You look pretty
Nice.
chill there.
It's a good look. You're looking very chill.
Well,
Okay,
I've been in
Burner.
the studio for 6 days. I'm a little burnt out right now.
Oh,
Yeah.
wow.
Okay,
Okay.
Werner, you know, a great way to start this is to say, okay, what are you doing this time? Because as we were saying earlier, you've crushed in music, you've crushed in cannabis, you've crushed in clothing. Is there anything you're not good at that you'd like to be good at?
Staying in shape. I have to learn how to get in the gym.
I was going to ask you how that amateur brain surgery was going, but
Yeah, staying in the gym is not easy these days, but otherwise I'm feeling good.
You absolutely should. So we love backstories here on Chatter. And I immediately zoned in on something when I was reading Burner. By the way, also great cover art. Great
Thank
cover
you.
art and great
Thank you.
continuation of the brand. But I know you from California, but you spent some time in Arizona when you
Yeah.
were quite young, and you talked about the underground rap scene in Chandler, Arizona. Burner, I spent a lot of time in Arizona. I find it hard to believe that it must have been very underground. But
Oh yeah,
that was your
extremely.
first start into a career path doing the music in Chandler?
Yeah, it was how I discovered being able to rap though in Chandler. Yeah, I mean, I was definitely influenced by the Bay Area rap scene, but when I was in Chandler, someone kind of challenged me to try to rap, and so that's where I actually got the nerves and the balls to do it.
Tell us about mom.
Oh, she
I
was the
know she,
best. Yeah.
but she comes through. I know she passed away a few years ago. I'm very sad about that. But she comes through in so many ways. And it sounds like mom saw something in you that you had an inkling of, but she was the one who said, no, he can do this. So at a young age, you wanted to go from Chandler, Arizona. I can't imagine wanting to leave Chandler, Arizona, back to San Francisco. And
Yeah.
you have a long conversation with your mom. So tell us about mom and how she pushed you into these incredible paths.
She just loved us very, very much, and so much that like I feel like it just changed the game for us, and like being creative and believing in ourselves and believing we could achieve whatever we want. Like she was a very supportive, loving person, and she used to tell me her mom was, her mom died when she was very young, and she had a stepmom that was a terrible mom to her. So she wanted to do for us what she always wanted for herself, and so I feel like that just like it was a game changer for us as kids. She empowered us, she believed in us, and she let us follow our dreams, which is very rare, like most parents. But you got to do this, or you better do this, or if you don't go to school, she's like, I don't know why you're not in school, but I know that whatever you're doing, there's a bigger picture, so I'm going to support you. So it's very, very, very cool relationship I have with my mom.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Okay, something that keeps coming up throughout the book, Burner, and it's really wonderful, is authenticity. Whether it was the genetics you put into growing particular strains of cannabis, I'll get all the words and phrases wrong, I'm sure, so sorry for that. But whether it was that or your music or the clothing line, and you talk so much about brands and vision, authenticity, is that a key to your vision and your processes?
With everything I do, I feel like real is rare these days. No one's really real anymore. So when you can be yourself, when you are yourself, it's refreshing. So I feel like if you can stay true to yourself, if you can be yourself, if you can stay authentic and organic and not be forceful and not be fake, and then it's gonna fucking go far.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about why this book, Burner, Becoming Legend, Get Rich and Leave a Legacy, which is fabulous. You know, as successful have you been in all these areas, whether it's music, clothing, or cannabis, really, really successful. A couple of my children had a shocking, not shocking, but surprising awareness of your business, by the way. Like, oh, okay, didn't know that about them. But what was it? Was it just hard work? You focus so much on the business themselves, highly successful, but you're not a media hound. You're on the cover of Forbes. There's a great New York Times profile, but you're not one of these people out there seeking lots of media opportunities from what I can see. And did you feel you didn't need to do that, or you wanted to focus more on those lines of business themselves? Why this book? Because this is putting you out there for people,
No, the
audiences like ours, who wouldn't necessarily know much about you.
well, the book is important for three reasons. One, I came very close to death, and either you tell your own story or someone tells it for you. So I wanted to tell my own story, at least the first piece of it, right? I think the second thing is that as an artist, as an entrepreneur, when I do things and when I'm out and about, people always tell me, "You inspire me. Can you give me some advice?" Or, "Your music helped me through some hard times. Can you give me some game?" Or, "We want to be like you in building a business. Can you tell me how you did it?" So I'm like, I owe it to them because I'm an underground guy and I have been blessed to be able to live off my art. So I feel like I owed it to them. I think the third thing is like, I've been through so much legal shit lately and people trying to take our brand. And the legal battle has been a nightmare. I've had to stay quiet for 3 years and it's been a life-changing experience for me and for my company. I feel like this is my chance with class to tell my side of the story, not going on podcasts, not going on Twitter and saying mean things. It's like, let me just be a baller about it and go tell my side of the story with a book through Penguin Random House. Like, that's the grown man way to do it. These guys have done smear campaigns on me through the internet and stuff like that. I'm like, that's cool. That's cute. That shit disappears within a few months. Let me go do something that'll last forever. So it was like a three-part reason why I wanted to write the book.
So, Bernard, the book Becoming Legend, is it an advice book, a memoir, both, something different? What would you, how would you characterize it?
I would say it's like a business memoir. It's like a roller coaster ride for entrepreneurs. It's also like, it's the way I built Cookies, which people always want to know. How did you do it? What'd you do right? What'd you do wrong?
So
What would you
Cookies
do
is your
different?
cannabis brand?
Yeah, it's my cannabis and clothing brand. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would be, what's the big advice takeaway? What do you tell people? You said let people ask you for
Buy the
advice.
book.
What do you
Buy the
tell them?
book,
Yeah,
Becoming
buy
Legend.
the book. That would be number one, I think,
Yeah.
right?
And now I guess the biggest takeaway is like, look, and this sounds very cheesy, but if I can do it, then you can do it. And that, the biggest thing I would take away from this book is that there's no blueprint to in new industries. Cannabis is a new industry. There was no blueprint. I'm kind of creating my own blueprint. And I think another thing is like, this is how you get over certain obstacles in business because there's not a lot of people that look like me in big business. Latinos and big business that have the kind of platform I have to share. And so I'm like, for young Latino entrepreneurs, like this is how you kind of get over certain obstacles as a business guy in a world, an industry where there's no blueprint.
Okay, it's not cheesy at all. No, David, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, man. First of all, real respect, man. I mean, I love people who do it their own way. I really do, because so many people just can't do that. And you've always, and I mean this in the best way, you hustle, and I mean that in the best way. And I just wonder, like, how does someone learn to constantly listen to that inner voice, that governor that says, this is the right way, even though nobody's doing it this way. I know this is the right way. How did you keep time after time when the money started getting really big and the attention and all that? How did you continue to go, no, I know what I'm doing. I know the way I'm doing it is the right way for me.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the book I talk about, you have to stick to your vision. And sometimes people won't understand your vision, but that's why it's vision, because not everyone should see what you see. So, at the end of the day, it's like, this is what got me here. Let's double down on that, right? And you're not always going to be right. But if your vision is to do something, then do it what you want to do. And no matter how hard it is, you're going to be forced to figure it out, right? There's no other better way to learn a lesson than the hard way. So I feel like for me, it was very easy. It's like, yo, this is what I see. This is how I picture it happening. I got to execute it. Like, if this goes wrong this way, or if this didn't resonate this way, I'm gonna go ahead and take another approach. So it was easy for me because I already seen this shit. I already seen it mapped out. I'm like, this is how it's gonna be. This is where I want to get, and this is how I'm gonna try to get there. And so there's been some changes along the way, but I never really double guess what I see or what I want to do. I just kind of do it.
Okay, I'm going to push back a little bit. I could see where you could look at what others were doing in music or looking at clothing, going, okay, I see how that's done. But the cannabis business, you know better than any of us, especially when they started to get to legalization, a lot of people wanted in on that business. I mean, there were a lot of powerful people in Washington, D.C. who thought, we're going to get into this big time. I can't even think of anybody who stuck with it and have been as successful as you. What made you stick with it?
Well, first thing first, I love weed. So when you love
That
weed, you understand and
helps.
know
You love
weed,
your
right?
product. Yeah.
And
What's
second
not
thing
to
is like,
love? Yes.
and that's they want to be in the business, but they don't understand the weed game. I've been selling weed since I've been a kid. So who's the best breeders in the game? Who's the best of cultivation in the game? Like, what's the flavor trends right now? What's going to get played out? What's going to be the next flavor trend, right? Like, you go look at my studio session. There's like 32 bags of weed on the goddamn couch. It's all new stuff I'm trying out. And so it takes time and dedication. A lot of these people want to get in the business world. They're all chasing EBITDA. They want to get EBITDA. They want to get profit margin. They want to build a CPG business. I want to sell weed. I want to sell great weed. I want people to be impressed by my weed. And that's the biggest difference is like, if you base it around the product, you're going to win. Like, it's like a small chef, like a mom and pop business. It's always going to taste better than some big ass chain, right? Like, chains can be cool, but chains are a bunch of people that don't really fucking care. They don't really care about the actual end result. They're there to do a job. They're there for a check, and that's about it, right? If you got a mom and pop business, a family that's been making food for X amount of years, you're always going to get a greater experience. So I feel like what made us different is that we focus on the flavors, the menu, and the cultivators, right? And that's what we really focus on.
How much did the legalization help or make things more challenging? I met a guy a couple of years ago at some wedding in LA, and nowhere near your level, but had a few cannabis stores or whatever. And he was saying that there's so much regulation in California of the business that if you were doing it legal, it made it really hard because you have to rules, regulations, jump through hoops, dot the I's, cross the T's.
Well, it made it difficult in a couple of different ways. One, it brought a bunch of vultures in that only had the intention to do sharky business. Two, it made the laws, like you said, super fucked up. Like, the time it takes from a product to get to a customer's hand, like actual like product being harvested and packaged to get to a customer's hands, it's all wrong. The taxes on things like the 280 and whatnot, it's not fair for business owners. It also like kind of slowly forced a lot of the great ones out, right? Like, people couldn't really stick up with regulation. They couldn't really stick up with, license process and stuff like that. So kind of just pushed a lot of the real original players out. But got a few of us that are still hanging in there. But yeah, regulations and legalization definitely changed it. I miss the medical days a lot more.
Yeah, you, I could ask you about a million things. I want, I love, I just love the story, man. But one thing that you seem to know early, and now I see it with my kids because they're young adults, 20 and 18. Nobody drinks anymore. Nobody, no kids, they don't drink anymore. They smoke. That's what they do. That's all they do. And I just, when did you know that you'd reach the tipping point where this generation just wasn't getting down like that anymore? And they didn't want to be around drunk people. They didn't like the whole vibe of drunk people. They just wanted to be in a place where they could smoke and be chill.
I think that I saw that at a very early age when I noticed how many different to walks of life actually enjoy cannabis. By working at the dispensary when I was 18, I saw off-duty cops, nurses, teachers, veterans. I saw all different types of people. And as kids, your circle of smoke weed. But I started seeing people that look like, wow, this lady's 72 and loves weed. She used to eat hash from Morocco till she, passed out. And so I'm like, damn, this is something that a lot of people enjoy. But also, like, understanding how bad things were being attacked by the alcohol and tobacco industry was like a big sign to it. They must not want this around because people probably will want to gravitate to alcohol. Comes with a lot. You forget what you do. You throw up. You don't feel good. You can hurt yourself. I feel like with alcohol always like kind of causing problems with people around me, and also like with how much I know they were lobbying in the background to kind of shut cannabis down, had to be good, right? So I feel like seeing the different types of people that use cannabis and also seeing why tobacco and big alcohol had a thing against cannabis. I'm like, yeah, I think there's probably gonna be a shift here soon. And I just enjoy cannabis, and I watch my friends as we get older be like, why are we gonna go to a club and pay three times the amount for this bottle because we're in a club? Like, it doesn't really make sense. And I feel like the whole
We
night
don't
all
want to drink anyway.
yeah, shit's done, dude. Like, people, when I'm with people, they want to microdose mushrooms or smoke weed. That's about it.
So is there a downside to it?
To cannabis?
Yeah. So I remember when I was in college, in before the turn of the century, You know, we always believe that, you know, marijuana was not addictive. It was much better than alcohol. But there's been, you know, research lately about people, about the effects of really heavy use over a long term. Are you concerned about that?
Well, look at steak, look at red meat, look at sugar, look at coffee, look at pharmaceutical drugs, look at anything. Anything in excess is bad for you. I don't care what it is, right? You can eat too much fruit and vegetables and not get the iron you need. So I feel like at the end of the day, is it bad? Is there any downside to it? There's downsides to everything, but it's a lot safer. It's a lot better. I would prefer my daughter that's in college to smoke weed instead of drinking with people. That's how girls get raped. That's how they end up somewhere they're not supposed to be. That's how they get in a car accident. So I think it's a lot safer than other things that are out there that have been legal for a long time. I think that we've been taught a lot of negative things about cannabis. I'm glad it's starting to come to light how positive it really is for us as people. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, when I had cancer, it's damn near the only thing that helped me keep food down. So I know for sure the medical benefits of it. And I think it's just good. I think it's great for people. I think that anything could, and using excess could be bad for you, but it's all about being a smart human being, right?
Yeah. When early in the book, in Becoming Legend, when you're talking about the Hemp Center, which I think was where your vision really started, I was thinking about all the people I know that have used and continue to use weed. There's one person, very old, quadriplegic. It's the only thing that gives them relief. My sister had cancer, only thing that gave her relief. Military veterans, Jamie, PTSD. It's the only thing that seems
to. I know military veterans who say it's the thing that
and
makes everything better.
Sanjay Gupta from CNN,
right?
For years.
Yep.
I'm greatly simplified, but he said weed not good, don't do it, those kinds of things. And then he spent significant amount of time doing research, and now he's an advocate.
He's a pretty busy. I remember watching Sanjay's story and thinking, wow, yeah, well, this is what happens when you actually investigate a story before you start reporting on it.
Right.
No comment there. Okay. Legacy. Talk about your legacy. Talk about your kids and what legacy you want to leave for them and for others, Werner.
Yeah, you know, the older you get, you kind of realize that legacy is damn near like the real wealth, right? Like, as a family and you have children, and, you know, you have a family name, and you, when you leave things behind, you know, one of the most important things you can leave behind is a good legacy, right? Like, it's, I think, what we all work hard for, to have a good legacy. At least what I work hard for. So it's important to me, and I think it's very important for my family. I want my kids to be proud of all stuff I've done, all the work I put in, and I just want to build something that lasts longer than me, you know, with the brand and with the company. So, you know, legacy is super important to me these days. I never really thought about it before, but definitely on my mind.
Has your family read the book?
My daughter has, yeah.
What was her reaction?
She loved it. She's like, dude, like, she's wanting it. She actually has 18 years old. She's a lot more interested in what her dad does. Like, she'd always known me to be on the road and do music. I'm always gone working hella much. So she's like, it's cool to see, you know, why you've been doing it, what you've been doing, and, you know, what we built, because our brand is known all around the whole world. Switzerland, Ireland, Spain, Germany, London, Thailand, Japan. Like, she's like, this is cool that you built something, and it's cool to see how you built it, right? Like, she feels like she knows more about me. We're very close. But, like, even like yesterday, she came to drive to the studio. She goes to school in UCSB, but she took like a 2-hour drive to come see a friend. She took another additional hour to come see me. And she's like, what are you doing here? Like, so what does your day look like here? I'm like, oh, let me show you. I got a photo shoot going in this room. I have my guys writing some music in this room. We have a dinner set up over here. And once I start breaking down the process, like, I really like to understand the process of what you do. I'm like, yeah, for sure. So it's cool. Like, she liked the book a lot. It was a good insight on, like, what her dad's been building.
Is she interested in the family business?
I try to make her interested. She's like, I saw an interview. You said you want me to be CEO. I'm like, I do. Because you know your dad very well, and you have a certain kind of aura to you that I feel like would be very, 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 very good for the business, as well as, like, you know, powerful women are dangerous. I think you could be dangerous.
Absolutely.
That is a great thing for a father to say to a daughter. My father put it slightly differently. Okay.
Yeah. I got to ask you, man. I know you get asked this all the time. How did you say no to Jay-Z and to Puff? How did you just, like, seriously, great, like, question. Even if you knew the ideas they had were bad? How did you say, nah, not for me?
Because we would say yes.
Can I give you the honest to God truth? Yeah, even like just take the bad ideas out the equation, right? I'm like, you guys are some East Coast OGs. I've had the lock on the game for a long time. I'm a West Coast boy, and I thought you guys are no different than me. I just haven't got to that level yet. I'll be there right next to you guys soon. So in my eyes, it's like, it's flattering that they want to work with me, but at the same time, like, I feel like, man, I got just as much I was just as much knowledge, charisma, and in motion right now to get to where they go, to where they're at. I feel like at a certain point you don't want to be under anyone. I'm like, I could be right next to you guys one day, and I felt that in my gut. I'm like, look, maybe right not right now, I'm not right next to you guys, but my brand is Cookies is a well-known brand. I feel like it'd almost be like giving up if I just let them have a big piece of it because they were who they were. I'm like, nah, I'm one of you guys. You guys just don't know it yet. So I'm younger, but like I'm the West Coast version. I'm the Bay Area version of what you guys did for New York, you know?
David, to your question, I'm giving all the credit to mom. That's
Moms are
intestinal
great.
fortitude that most people don't have, and it can come from very few places. So I'm giving a lot of credit to mom.
Hey Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatteron Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay. The guy's burner. The book is Becoming Legend, Get Rich and Leave a Legacy. The subhead, by the way, is The $1 Billion Blueprint to Be a Whale in a Sea of Sharks. Burner, it's fabulous. Really, really great to meet you. I feel like I kind of knew who you were, but thank you to Ashley, your publicist, who reached out to us, because I'm really glad she did, and I'm really glad you spent some time with us. Good luck with
Yeah.
everything and come back someday, okay?
I will. I'm glad you guys read the book. I'm glad you enjoyed it too. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It's
Thank
terrific.
you,
Take
Bernard.
care. See ya.
All right,
All
baby.
right,
All right,
Mike.
bye.
See you, buddy.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, everybody go out and
Nicole.
buy Berner's book. It's
Yes, it's a good book.
BERNER, by
Good
the
book.
way. It's a really good
So
book. And I really, again, if you're at all have an entrepreneurial streak and want to, advice, it's very
yeah.
real practical advice that he
No,
scatters in
you
throughout
everything he
this.
does, he hits. You were right, Tori.
Yeah,
It's, this
exactly.
is not a one-note guy. Like, no, pardon the pun, but no, I mean, he's good at a lot of things. Like, he's got a real bent for this. I mean,
Yeah.
he's gonna do this, so.
Yep. And we're back. It's in a week. Apologies, everybody. We've got to do this another week with James Grady, our iconic James Grady, who's got his book out, Shadows on Sidewalks, which is very, very cool. And maybe another couple authors for the pitch, but that might wait a couple of weeks as well. Meantime, thanks, everybody.
All right, this was
Bye,
fun.
guys. That's a first. That's a first for us. Love that.
All right.